This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, April 7th, 2006. Filling in for Out of Bogado, I'm Mitch Jezerich from Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. A so-called compromise bill on immigration fails its first test in the Senate. The White House does not deny that the president authorized a leak of the identity of a CIA operative. And a lawsuit in California attempts to stop the use of Diebold electronic voting machines. All these stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. A double suicide bombing at a Shiite mosque in northern Baghdad today killed at least 70 people. David Enders reports.
The bombing came a day after a bombing in Najaf near one of the holiest shrines in Shiite Islam that killed 10 people, and it was at least the third bombing of a Shiite mosque this week. Baratha Mosque, struck today, is considered the headquarters mosque for the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, one of the country's two main Shiite parties. The mosque bombings have further exacerbated sectarian tensions, but have also prompted strong anti-American rhetoric from Shiites, increasingly eager to take over security responsibilities, saying that the U.S. has failed in its duties to secure Iraqi cities. In Baghdad, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
In Nepal, a four-day general strike called by the country's sidelined political parties continued into its second day today. King Gyanendra took total control of Nepal's political system in February 2005, in what many refer to as a palace coup. Police have detained hundreds in Kathmandu since the strike began yesterday. Pro-democracy activists are calling for massive demonstrations tomorrow. Opponents to Thailand's Prime Minister Shinawatra continue to mobilize to press for political change. Severine Bardone reports from Bangkok.
20,000 people gathered tonight in the heart of Bangkok in a cheerful atmosphere filled of music and entertainment. They came to celebrate what they consider a victory over the Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat, who announced he would not pursue another term as Prime Minister despite his party's victory in Sunday's elections. Leaders of the People's Alliance of Democracy, a loose association of opposition personalities which organized the previous demonstrations, came on stage to celebrate with their militants, but also to announce their next battle plans. Thailand's opposition is not yet fully convinced that Thaksin will abandon his political influence, and the alliance is now pressing for a constitutional reform that would include more checks and balances on the Prime Minister's powers. Thailand's political crisis is not over yet, since further elections must be held before the parliament can gather and eventually choose a new Prime Minister who could lead the necessary reforms. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Severine Bardon in Bangkok.
A World Health Organization report released today has found that 57 countries have critical shortages of health workers. Most affected are countries in sub-Saharan Africa, where 36 nations are experiencing chronic shortfalls in healthcare staff. According to the report, sub-Saharan Africa has 11% of the world's population and 24% of the global burden of disease, but only 3% of the world's health workers. Two Israeli airstrikes in southern Gaza killed 6 people today, including 2 children. This afternoon, the U.S. State Department announced the suspension of hundreds of millions of dollars of aid to the Hamas-led Palestinian Authority. This comes just after the European Union implemented a similar measure today. Leila El-Haddad has more from Gaza.
The EU Commission said it had halted all payments to the Palestinian government because the new cabinet had not yet recognized Israel's right to exist or renounced the use of arms. Hamas on Friday condemned the decision as collective punishment, saying it would only increase the suffering of the Palestinian people and provide, quote, a cover for the Israeli occupation. Government officials also said the move would make Hamas more popular and spoke of a double standard since Israel, the largest recipient of U.S. aid, had not yet recognized Palestinian rights. The shortage of funds have forced the new government to delay paying salaries to employees, including some 50,000 armed security forces. The new Hamas government has inherited an authority that is more than $1.3 billion in debt. Since they swept to power in democratic elections in January, the Israeli government has imposed a prolonged closure on Gaza that has led to food shortages and withheld some $50 million in monthly tax revenues. Meanwhile, the International Relations Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives yesterday passed a bill that would bar almost all aid to the PA. The World Bank recently warned that as a result of the sanctions, the Palestinian Authority faces imminent collapse, something that could lead to more violence and chaos unless a long-term funding plan is developed by the U.S.-led quartet. For Free Speech Radio News in Gaza, this is Leila El-Haddad.
In the U.S., students continue mobilizing around pending immigration legislation currently under debate in the Senate. 40 students from Wilson High School went to the Los Angeles Unified School District board meeting last night to make three demands. Students want the board to make a resolution against H.R. 4437 to declare all schools in the district safe zones for all students, regardless of immigration status, and to urge the board to stop the use of punitive measures like school lockdowns. Alex Ramirez is a 17-year-old student.
The school board gave a lot of people time to speak, and they wanted to hear what was our opinions, and they pretty much took it well, and they really liked it, and they were, from my view, I think they were pretty much with us.
The board is still considering the demands. Protests against a proposed bilateral free trade agreement between the United States and Ecuador have left one student dead and two others injured by live ammunition in the city of Cuenca in southern Ecuador. Yesterday's deadly protest was part of a series of actions carried out this week in Ecuador to pressure the government to pull out of the free trade negotiations. Indigenous organizations playing a key role in the protests say that dozens of activists have been arrested in recent days. President Alfredo Palacio declared a state of exception on March 21st in various parts of the country where mobilizations have been most intense. Organizations opposed to the free trade agreement say it compromises national sovereignty and will have a devastating impact on domestic agriculture. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The White House today declined to challenge the assertions that President Bush authorized a leak of the identity of a CIA operative, Valerie Plame, to the public. Valerie Plame is the wife of Ambassador Joe Wilson, who provided evidence suggesting that Saddam Hussein never tried to buy uranium from Niger, so to build a nuclear weapon. Court documents show that former chief of staff for the vice president, Scooter Libby, who has been indicted for obstructing the investigation into the leak, has said that the president gave his final authorization for the leak. Free Speech Radio News spoke with the ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, John Conyers of Detroit, about the matter.
So it's not a good sign. It shows that the president was directly involved, contrary to his other comments, that he wasn't, was involved in this. And so we in Congress have a responsibility to ask the president to come forward and clear this up for us, because it's very troubling, and of course it's very damaging to him.
But do you think that Congress, that is dominated by the president's party, will actually have the political will to look into this?
Well, I think the evidence is mounting that the president has been involved in at least one of these unauthorized disclosures. And what we're looking for now is Republican congressmen who are now willing to ask that we have an official investigation by a select committee. But over and above the Congress, the American people have to feel as shocked as we are to know that already it's come out that the president was involved in this one leak.
So you introduced this year a resolution of inquiry earlier in the year to investigate the president. Such a resolution is also a first step in possible impeachment proceedings. Do you think that the Democrats, if they captured the House, would move forward with your resolution?
Well, the reason that I answer yes to your question is that all the 30-something members who are already signed on to it are all Democrats. So in a House controlled by the Democrats, there'd be a new revisiting of this subject matter, and I think it would be examined far more seriously and with greater care than has been done so far.
And that was Democratic Representative John Conyers of Detroit. Meanwhile, in the Senate, a so-called compromise bill on immigration failed to receive enough votes for passage today. Selena Masuda has more from Capitol Hill.
Each party blamed the leadership of the other for Friday's impasse. Democrats complained that Republicans pushed unfriendly amendments to the proposal sponsored by Republican Senators Mel Martinez of Florida and Chuck Hagel of Nebraska that would change the intent of the bipartisan compromise. Republicans like Majority Leader Bill Frist of Tennessee criticized Democrats for not allowing any amendments to even be brought to the floor for debate.
The debate has been reasonably civil and reasonably dignified, but there's been one huge problem, and that problem was created by the Democratic leadership, and that was that we were going to deny the expression of the will, the intent of 99 other United States senators.
On a procedural vote, the Martinez-Hagel compromise received only 38 votes out of 60 needed, therefore shelving the overall immigration bill for now. The Senate will convene for a two-week recess. In that time, the Senate Judiciary Committee will craft new language for the underlying bill. Pennsylvania Republican Arlen Specter is the chair of the Judiciary Committee.
You don't have to be an optimist to say that there has been some progress, because we had quite a number of senators, how many I don't know, who liked the committee bill with the modifications from Senator Hagel and Senator Martinez. Some other people want to be heard, and we can get it done fast.
The committee is expected to send the legislation to the majority leader the Thursday the Senate comes back from recess. Even if the Senate reaches a decision on the legislation this year, the bill would still have to go to conference in order to reconcile the Senate bill with the House version that centers on enforcement and not legalization. But Martinez is confident that the conference committees can combine the two bills into one.
I was so encouraged by the number of calls and messages that I was receiving from across the hall, from the members of the House on our party, who were saying, thank you. This is a good thing. We appreciate what you've done there. This is now something I can get behind. And so for those who would believe that the two houses can't come together on this issue, I'd say they're wrong.
Despite the claims from Martinez and Hagel that this bill is supported by immigration groups, not all do. Benita Jane is the staff attorney of the NYSDA Immigrant Defense Project.
Both the Judiciary Committee bill and the Hagel-Martinez bill contain specific provisions that, you know, we think would be disastrous for immigrant communities, include things like expanding minor offenses that would be considered aggravated felonies. That's important because someone that has one of these offenses is subject pretty much to mandatory deportation.
And despite the Martinez-Hagel compromise, protests are continuing throughout the country. On Thursday, students at Washington, D.C.'s Bell Multicultural High School walked out of their last period to protest the immigration bill and demanded that Congress support the DREAM Act instead, a bill that would allow undocumented students who graduate from high school and who want to go to college an opportunity to attain legal status and apply for federal loans and work-study programs. Leslie Cruz is a Bell senior whose family emigrated from El Salvador.
Students, the ones that migrate here to this country, it's so they could get a better life. But some universities, they don't let them get educated because of the fact they don't have a green card or whatever. You know, help them out.
April 10th has been called a national day of demonstrations against the immigration reform bill. Selena Masuda, FSRN in Washington, D.C.
In Jordan, a rocky reconstruction expo in Amman is underway, in which participants say that very little progress has been made on the reconstruction of the chaos-stricken country. Aula Forawadi has more.
3 years after the occupation of Iraq, Iraqi's optimism about a better life after the fall of the dictatorship of the Ba'ath Saddam Hussein is dwindling. Iraqi participants at the third Iraqi reconstruction expo in Jordan spoke of insecurity, lack of infrastructure, and a meager progress in the reconstruction of the war-torn country. However, during a press conference in Baghdad last week, the U.S. director of the Iraqi Reconstruction Management Office said Iraq has witnessed a tremendous boom in reconstruction and economic development. But many Iraqis taking part in the expo said they did not see any of that.
Yeah.
It is media hype.
Julia Yaqub, an Iraqi businesswoman, said. Yaqub said that power outages are the norm. There is less electricity available than before the war began. Fewer people have clean water and sanitation systems, and fuel production isn't at pre-war levels. Some $32 billion US dollars was pledged for reconstruction at an October 2003 donor conference. The US alone has allocated $21 billion to the rebuilding effort, making it the largest contributor. U.S. officials said the slow progress is largely a result of continued insurgent attacks on infrastructure and the need to divert building dollars to protection costs. But Iraqis say there also has been evidence of mismanagement, fraud, and incompetence in the reconstruction efforts. Day-to-day existence is very gloomy. Iraqi businessman Haider Mosawi, who works in pharmaceuticals, says that most of the time he's afraid to leave his house.
We live in Baghdad and it's so hard to move around. Days and days pass and we don't get to go out. The markets close very often and we are constantly worried about our safety because anyone can get killed or get assassinated. We don't see anything in the future. It will surprise me to see change in the short run. What we see is completely bizarre. You don't know your friend from your enemy, and influential people are benefiting from this.
He added that American troops were not helping to bring about any security.
The soldiers are well secured in military bases. When an American is in the street, he immediately becomes a target, and with him die tens of innocent Iraqis.
Iraqi engineer Munaim Naim, who directs an electronic appliances company, said he became disenchanted with the reconstruction effort and added that this was the last time he was going to take part in any reconstruction fair.
When the war finished and the dictatorship was ended, there was supposed to be reform. I don't see any change for the better in the near future. We want to escape Iraq. I bought a house and I am moving to Amman, even if I don't find a job there. We can't go on living in a minefield.
In Amman, Jordan, this is Ola Farawati reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
A lawsuit has been filed to stop the use of Diebold electronic voting machines in California after a state report on the voting machines identified numerous security flaws in the system. Free Speech Radio News' Christina Anastad reports.
The suit claims Diebold's TSX electronic voting machines provide inaccurate results, fail to accommodate people with disabilities, and can be easily tampered with and hacked. John Eichhorst is co-counsel in the suit.
We have a lot of people who are already disenfranchised in our state and in our country, and the last thing we need is to give people serious reason to question whether or not in the end, if their own votes are not going to be counted. And that is not something that we think is compliant with the California constitutional rights of our plaintiffs and of our citizens, and it's not in compliant with the state elections code.
The suit alleges Diebold's voting machines violate state and federal voting laws, including the Federal Help America Voting Act and the California Voting Act. Bernice Kandarian was legally blind at age 5. She is now president of the California Council of Citizens with Low Vision International, and a plaintiff in the suit to stop the recertification of voting machines she says hinders her ability to vote.
I'm just so frustrated about this whole thing because it seems like the machines that are out there are just not yet adequate enough to be reliable and are not providing the appropriate kinds of access. For 80% of the people, it needs to have reverse polarity, which means a dark background with light letters. And then the letters need to be in a sans serif font so that they're easy to read. We just have not, there is not such a machine out there in my experience at this time.
A state independent report issued in February found that Diebold's electronic voting machines contain 16 bugs and runs on a memory card commonly used in PC computers that can be reprogrammed to change voting results. Douglas Jones, a professor of computer sciences at Iowa State University, is an expert in electronic voting systems and a witness in the suit.
To use an analogy, this is like having Ford sell all of their cars keyed alike so that anyone who owns a Ford can open the door on any other Ford and start the car. As things stand right now, the key became public knowledge in 2003. That key has still not been changed. That means that anyone who wants to forge the election results for a Diebold voting machine can forge them because that key is publicly available.
But despite the findings in security and access flaws, California Secretary of State Bruce McPherson recertified the Diebold machines earlier this year, and community members aren't the only ones riled up over it. California State Senator and Chair of the Senate Committee that focuses on elections, Deborah Bowen, sent a letter to McPherson demanding he retract the certification of Diebold's voting machines. State Secretary McPherson did not return calls. Plaintiffs say they are suing the Secretary of State to stop Diebold's recertification until the machines comply with California and federal law. Similar suits have occurred in Pennsylvania, New York, New Mexico, and Arizona. The Secretary of State and over 15 counties have until the end of April to respond to the complaint. Attorneys hope the suit will be heard sometime this summer before the 2006 elections. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Christina Onnestad.
The Massachusetts legislature has passed a bill earlier this week aimed at bringing health care coverage to all of the state's residents. On paper, at least, it sounds like a lofty goal, but achieving it can become another matter. From Boston, Chuck Rosina has more.
It is not single-payer state-sponsored health care, but rather a plan to require everyone to have private insurance. Under the plan, the state will continue to fund health care for the very poor, those living below the poverty line. Others, earning up to $30,000 for individuals, will receive subsidies on a sliding scale to help offset the cost of private insurance. Individuals earning over $30,000 a year, however, will be on their own to get mandated health insurance. Massachusetts legislators are hoping that insurance companies will provide a low-cost plan of around $300 per month, but what it will actually provide and how the plan will be implemented is still yet to be resolved. Also, small businesses with less than 11 employees under this bill will be required to now provide insurance. Benjamin Day is executive director of MassCare, an advocacy group for single-payer health care.
We don't see it as a step in the right direction because it's essentially part of our Republican governor, Mitt Romney, has been driving the main portion of the bill, which legally requires all individuals to buy their own health insurance. And if they don't buy their own health insurance, then they are penalized through the tax system. The truth is, we have no idea what's going to be covered or not because the bill calls for a low premium insurance plan. However, the insurance companies haven't actually produced a plan.
Patricia Jalen is a progressive voice in the Massachusetts Senate. She was not available for comment, but her chief of staff, David Jordan, offered.
The health care legislation that was passed here this week is really landmark legislation that aims to cover 95% of the population over the next 3 years. They used a creative approach, spreading the cost and the responsibility among all sectors of the economy. Individuals and businesses and government all have responsibility in providing coverage.
The idea is to provide affordable health care for all, but what is affordable to an individual or small business?
As part of the legislation, there was a board that is going to determine and sort of implement the policies and define what is affordable. And I think that is where the public needs to be vigilant and the legislators are still going to look to have input in determining affordability.
When asked about MassCare's advocacy for state-sponsored single-payer health care, David Jordan only responded by saying that the rest of the nation is now looking to Massachusetts as a way to make health care affordable for everyone. And he hoped it would serve as an example to extend to the 45 million uninsured Americans across the country. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Chuck Rosina reporting from Boston.
The warring nations around Africa's Great Lake regions, as well as the United Nations and the African Union, are meeting in Kampala in an attempt to work out an economic deal that could lead to greater peace among the nations. The Great Lakes region has the largest natural resource base that attracts foreign attention and became a theater for Cold War fighting between the East and the West in the 1950s. This wealth has until now served multinational mining companies and the warlords, but not the Congolese people. Joshua Kailimpa reports from Kampala.
The Great Lakes region, that includes the Democratic Republic of Congo, has some of the highest poverty levels in the world, despite having some of the most precious minerals. After the fall of communism, when the East and West nearly went to war in Zaire, now renamed DRC, the minerals are the cause of conflict in the region, as stronger countries attack weaker ones to loot the precious metals, or are used by foreign interests to plunder. The UN and regional governments are proposing a new initiative that they say will remove minerals from the hands of warlords and put it into genuine hands for the benefit of the people. James Mugambe is the chairperson of the UN focal point for projects aimed at peace building in the region.
We have been trying to build confidence and trust so that we can focus on developmental objectives. There was plunder of resources, aggression, illegal exploration of natural resources and all that. We are recommending that two things should happen. One, we should have legal mechanisms, but at the same time we should have the strengthening of government structures so that a country should be able to protect both its borders and also its resources. Because sometimes if you don't guard your borders, people can exploit your resources. If you don't guard your resources, people can exploit them illegally. But again, you must also put mechanisms in which people can trade normally and formally. Now, certification is one of them, to be able to mark resources, to allow people to formally exploit, process, and trade.
However, some analysts believe that the certification of minerals will not make people benefit from their natural resources in the region, but will only remove the business from the locals and give a monopoly to the multinational companies to trade. In Mbujimayi, the provincial capital of Katanga in DRC, where around $400 million in diamonds transit every year on their way to Antwerp and Tel Aviv, there is no electricity and people often walk long distances to look for water. Professor Samuel Tindifa is the director of the Human Rights and Peace Center of Makerere University in Uganda.
I don't believe that, because minerals themselves are not a problem. The problem is those people who are interested in those minerals and the way they want to get them. I know that a number of companies from Israel and I think US and the UK were involved in the plunder, much as they are not mentioned anywhere. And some of them are connected to political parties in the United Kingdom, for instance, and powerful families in the US. It goes back again to the old colonial agenda. We look out for raw materials, for wealth. Take, for instance, the issue of oil in Nigeria. It's getting out of hand. You can see that that is a reaction to the fact that there is a multinational corporation mining oil, but the resources that come from this oil don't meet the needs of the communities. Maybe they're plundered by the state. You know, the whole process and agenda is to eliminate all competitors, to leave it to the big businesses. I don't think peace would be created by just merely controlling the way the minerals are extracted.
Dozens of multinationals, including the British Barclays Bank, South Africa's De Beers, and Anglo-American, were accused of facilitating the plan of the Democratic Republic of Congo's wealth by a panel of independent experts appointed by the UN Security Council. The experts in their report named 85 multinational companies based in Europe, the US, and South Africa as having violated OECD ethical guidelines in dealing with criminal networks to pillage natural resources from the war-torn Central African country. The scramble for gold, diamonds, coltan, cobalt and copper by multinationals using government officials and entrepreneurs from Congo and neighboring African countries generates billions of dollars which find eastward the mining companies and financial institutions in the West. Wars in the region have left millions dead and the infrastructure destroyed. Great Lakes region member states require about $2 billion for projects intended to bring harmony and a new zone of peace and prosperity in a record 5 years. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpa reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
Free Speech Radio News is an independent program produced out of Pacifica stations KPFK in Los Angeles and KPFA in Berkeley. The newscast is produced by Monica Lopez, Simba Russo, and Aldo Bogado. Headlines editor is Shannon Young. DC editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team is Jade Pageant-Seekins, Eric Klein, and Antonio Ortiz. For archives of this or other newscasts or documentaries, visit our website at www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. Filling in for Aldo Bogado, I'm Mitch Cesarich.